start the recording, and then I'll introduce us. Let's make sure that's started. Okay, that's going on. So, hi, everyone. Thank you for joining me on this webinar. Today, we're going to find out why there's such an epidemic of children with potentially deadly peanut allergies. I'm your host, Maria Rickert-Hong, a certified holistic health counselor trained at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition. I specialize in nutritional recovery from symptoms of autism, ADHD, asthma, allergies, autoimmune diseases, digestive issues, and neurological disorders because all of these issues are related. You can find out more about me at my website, which is www.mariarickert, which is R-I-C-K-E-R-T, hong.com, and you'll find blogs there about things like recovery, toxicity, nutrition, gut dysbiosis, and recipes, and you can also sign up for a free report about reducing pain and inflammation with food if you sign up for my newsletter. I'm also a board member of the 501c3 nonprofit Epidemic Answers, where we're passionate about letting parents know that recovery is possible from these types of conditions. You can also find me on Facebook and Google+, also on Twitter, and you can also find me on Pinterest, and that's my most popular hangout. My guest today is Heather Fraser. She is the author of The Peanut Allergy Epidemic, What's Causing It and How to Stop It. Her newest book is Allergy Relief, Using Acupressure to Help Relieve Minor Allergy Symptoms. Heather's website is www.heatherfraser, that's FRASER.org, and she performs her Body Talk practitioner work at Davignon Digestive Health in Toronto, Canada. You can find her on Facebook as well as LinkedIn. She's also on our film advisory committee at Epidemic Answers to help us get our film made documenting the recovery of 7 to 10 children with autism, ADHD, allergies, and Lyme. So welcome, Heather, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is wonderful. I haven't really talked very much about the book for about a year now, I guess. And where shall we start? There's a lot to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about, and I think just defining what the epidemic is, because I think, you know, if you're a parent, you go into your kid's school and you find nut-free classrooms and, you know, nut-free schools and nut-free cafeterias and, you know, EpiPens everywhere and the fear of anaphylaxis. And so just defining what the epidemic is, I think, would be helpful to a lot of people.
Well, I think the most common refrain that I hear is from parents when they were young, when I was young, no one had heard of this. And then suddenly it seemed about 20, a little over 20 years ago or so, it seemed suddenly, almost overnight, that we had this change where we were confronted by, it seemed, a flood of severely allergic kids, not only with peanut and nut allergies, but we know about the top 8 allergens that can be so deadly. And the numbers just kept growing, and it's become a medical, social, political issue. Communities have struggled with it within the classroom. Obviously, parents told not to send certain foods to school. There's the hand washing. There's a lot of seems to be some. Of course, there's conflict within that. About a year ago, there was that issue in Florida where a little girl was so severely allergic to peanuts that they had hand washing and mouth rinsing, and their parents objecting to that, and so on. That's kind of where people just stop and they wonder. And they go, "My gosh, this is such a mystery. Where has this come from? Why do we have it?" And last statistic from the CDC was about 3% of children under the age of 18 with life-threatening allergy, with about 2% to peanut and nut in particular, and then the other stat was 8% with overall food issues, that they avoided certain foods. Mm-hmm. So, but my specific interest, of course, was in the peanut and the nut because my son was diagnosed. He's 18 now, so this was in 1995 when he was about a year old, and he reacted violently to peanut butter that I gave him on a little piece of toast. And I had never seen a reaction before. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know anybody with allergy. And, of course, off to the hospital, he had a moderate reaction, they called it. We were there overnight. We had biphasic, and then we're given this diagnosis and the EpiPens, and oh, my God, where do we go from there? And I didn't know anybody else who had this. And so it was, you know, once you get over the shock and you start living with it, and then you start to see in your community the numbers that were growing at the time. And I didn't come to write about this until, I guess about 4 years ago, I started to write about this and to dig deeply when he'd gotten to a point where he was, you know, could sort of take care of himself a little better, and maybe my anxiety had ebbed to a degree, mm-hmm. that things were more under control. And so I began to read and research online, got books, and I just kept reading and reading, and a picture started to form for me of what had happened, but from a historical perspective. I'm not a medical doctor, and so my background being in history, as an art curator at a museum, this is where I started, and as a teacher, I used the tools I had to investigate and find out, well, what's happened? Because, you know, by that time, of course, we had so many, and it was such an issue. So from a historical perspective, I put it like this, as in what happened. I used the evidence, okay, about around 1990, something changed suddenly, just for kids and in specific countries, to cause severe allergy in an entire generation of kids. And those right. countries were, yeah, you could Canada, the United States, the UK, one part of Australia, the administrative capital that they have their act, not Tasmania, and I point that out for a specific reason. They didn't have peanut allergy apparently in Tasmania at the time. But suddenly they had the rising numbers around 1990 and more evidence, back-to-back cohort studies out of the UK from the Isle of Wight, where I understand they do have resources and money to do types of research, and they found that the numbers had grown so dramatically in about 4 years from less than 1% to towards 2% suddenly, and it was a complete mystery. And then, of course, you have ER records
right.
where it indicates a sudden rise in admissions for food anaphylaxis in children. And then by the early 90s, you had reports from teachers on the front line suddenly confronted by a surge, and that's a quote from a teacher, of severely allergic kids in the early 90s. So mm-hmm. we know, and that's the first big clue, is that we know something happened suddenly, just to kids, and these are the historical pieces that I put together, and
right.
then you kind of backtrack from there, and you ask, well, of all the possibilities that there could be that could create this so precisely, just in kids, just in these particular geographical areas in these countries, you know, you then start to dig a little further into history to find out what those could be,
mm-hmm.
And gather your evidence from there. And so really the book that I wrote relies on history to give us these answers. It, you know, I incorporate, of course, the medical literature, and but it's something that if you were to ask a doctor about today, that they would just either point to the hygiene hypothesis, not a bad thing, but they would
mm-hmm.
kind of shrug their shoulders and they would say, oh, well, okay, now let's just move on to treatment.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the hygiene hypothesis is and why that doesn't fully explain what's going on?
Well, when I wrote the book, the hygiene hypothesis, they've tacked on a couple of things in the last year. When I began, they had conflated two elements. One was about helminths or parasites, and they had noticed that in countries where they have high levels of parasites in the gut, they had low levels of allergy, and that's true that there are some parasites that will neutralize inflammation within the gut and block allergic reactions. It doesn't prevent you from having screaming high IgE. You still have the allergy, but as long as you've got the parasites, it will dampen the inflammatory response in the body,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's just an evolved, they say that's a co-evolved relationship between humans and parasites. I think it's just the parasites taking advantage of the human, because if you continue to have parasites, you'll become extremely ill.
Right.
Anyway, so there was that element that they then mixed with the idea that we're not fully exposed in Western countries to sufficient numbers of pathogens to balance the immune system. They've got that Th1, Th2 paradigm that they point to as the balance, and that we've messed this up in Western societies with our sanitizing products, with the hand washing and keeping things super clean and staying away from germs and so on. At that point, though, they weren't including pharmaceuticals, which are the hugest bug-altering elements that I can imagine, the antibiotics and vaccines that affect the immune system and change the balance within the body, affect the immune system directly. So at that time, they weren't incorporating those. And that was my biggest concern about the hygiene hypothesis. But now you will get, and this was just a couple of months ago, I got very excited about a Fox News report where New York allergist Dr. Sitterer, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, was quoted. This was from an email that he had sent to Fox News, and he included in the hygiene hypothesis antibiotics and vaccinations as playing a role in in upsetting the immune systems of millions of children, basically, and contributing to the massive rise in anaphylaxis that we see today. And I emailed him right away, and I said, "This is amazing. You're making a complete picture here. How wonderful!" And I think he sort of got a little suspicious of me. he emailed back, and he said, "You know, just to be absolutely clear here, it's just a theory, and every child should be fully, completely, 100% vaccinated. There's no question about that, and there should be no discussion about it either." And so that was that for that. But, you know, moving forward, I'm seeing it more and more in the discussions about anaphylaxis. And there was a World Health Organization report that came out that also pointed to, you know, the pharmaceuticals, the role of pharmaceuticals. But again, being very careful to say, you know, fully vaccinate. Do not, you know, completely in support of, do not miss any shots, basically.
Right.
So that's the hygiene hypothesis as it's expanded now, and this is what they point to, but it's still theoretical, and, you know, that's where they stop, and that's where they draw the line.
Right. Further research needs to be done is usually what they say.
Well, then the question would be, well, if you're pointing to pharmaceuticals, are you going to do some, you know, independent research into the role of these in the causing imbalance within the body? Well, no.
That's hard to get because
publicly.
you can't find the grants, you can't find the money to actually research those things. Who's going to give you the money to do that?
Yeah.
That money usually comes from pharmaceutical companies.
it is such a hot subject. And, of course, when I came out with my book, and I, you know, my conclusion is because at the same time as these, you've got your historical moment when things suddenly changed, and everybody's wondering silently to themselves, well, what role does vaccination play in this?
Mm-hmm.
And people are hesitant and afraid because as soon as you, of course, bring up the subject of vaccination playing a role, you're ostracized, you're shunned, you're shut down, you're frozen out. But I didn't know how to tell the story without telling the story. I couldn't not talk about this because it seemed to be playing such a central role historically as well. Would you like me to talk a little bit about
So tell us about the history of it. I mean, you even go back to like the early 1900s and even late 1800s, I believe, when you talk about that. So yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah, I think doctors, you know, have convenient amnesia when it comes to some of these things, or maybe they just don't know. Maybe they're not taught some of the history of vaccination. But going back to when it was first introduced with the hypodermic syringe, it's hard to, you know, imagine that it was brand new about 120 years ago. It was brand new, and that's like a blink of an eye in human history, that they introduced the vaccine. First, it was for it was an antitoxin for diphtheria, and this was, as I mentioned, around 1890, introduced for the first time, or 1895, and they discovered in the children that they were vaccinating that there was a bit of a problem, that about 50% of the kids were developing these really strange symptoms that they'd never seen before. And there were, of course, they were scrambling to try and figure out what was happening, that the kids were getting ill from the shots, and they had to even find new words to describe what was happening with the kids. And there were two doctors at the same time. One was, one was Austrian, one was French, Clemens von Fouquet, who coined the term allergy after he had meticulously examined and written on what was happening with the kids. And in Latin, it was altered reactivity, because he found that the symptoms the kids were having were similar to those that he had seen in people with reactions to bees, for instance, or even mosquitoes, which is an histamine reaction as well.
Right.
So we unleashed allergy there, brand new word. And then the second was, you're probably familiar with Charles Richer, who won the Nobel Prize in 1913 for his work on anaphylaxis that he coined following his own vaccination experiments with dogs. And he unleashed this deadly reaction accidentally by trying to develop a vaccine. And anyway, he continued to do his research in the laboratory and unleashed anaphylaxis on cats and rats and dogs and horses and any mammal. And he discovered that anaphylaxis is, in fact, a universal, naturally an evolved response that all mammals will create within themselves under certain conditions, and which they had unleashed accidentally in its various forms in children around 1895 and moving forward. So that's some of the history of where these words came from and under what conditions they were found. And anyway, I move forward in time from there to kind of track where, because there's no mention of peanut allergy in the literature that I could find. There's a mention of a nut allergy in one, but you know, there's no real epidemic of food anaphylaxis. There's allergy in general. People are struggling with foods. There's a problem with the shots that they were calling serum sickness, and they managed to correct that over time by understanding that it was the proteins within the shots that seemed to be affecting the kids and causing this defensive response. But it wasn't until at the close of World War II, and I'm always careful about this, but when the antibiotics were introduced for the first time and saved scores of people, there's no question it was such a valuable, important wonder drug, they called it. But it had a little problem, and that is that when they injected it, it didn't last. The body would excrete it. And so there was an army doctor by the name of Romanski who came up with a specific formula to slow it so that when you injected it into the body, it would remain kind of as a depot within the body and then be slowly like a time release from the body. And what he used at this time was beeswax and peanut oil. And now, I'm really careful about this, though, because even though refined peanut oil, where the proteins are removed, became kind of a traditional excipient or substance, an additive that they put into various products over time, and it did sensitize people, I'm really, really careful, though, to say to people, because this is where they jump up and down, and I say, no, there's no peanut oil, that there's no evidence that there's refined peanut oil in the children's vaccines. No, that's not the case. And by talking about the peanut oil, it's an important part of history that it was there and has been there and continues to be there in certain products, but we don't know where it is. I don't know where it is. There's no evidence. I found no evidence that it's there. And, you know, even if it were somewhere in there, it doesn't explain the other allergens. You've got more kids by the age of five who are anaphylactic to dairy than are anaphylactic to nuts, but kids tend to grow out of the dairy anaphylaxis where the peanut and nut tends to remain. And I think that's where it gets its reputation. It just doesn't seem to go away in about 80% of the people who develop it, that it traditionally has remained. So,
right. So you're saying that the vaccines were formulated with peanut oil and they no longer are? Or?
No. The antibiotics that were used, the penicillin was injected, and they did use it for a very long time, but they were very, very careful to refine it. And it's also important as to how they inject it as well, so that they don't, you know, you don't direct things into the vein, because that's a deadly thing to do. As I say, around 1970, it's sort of like the trail runs cold, that it is so difficult to find what types of ingredients that they're using. You'll find some lists on the CDC, but if you were to try and look for more information on these, that you're sort of barred from access, you can't really find out. I'm going to suggest that, you know, as again, there's no evidence that there was peanut oil used in the pediatric vaccines. I don't see that at all. I see that most what seems to have happened around 1990, and again, just sticking with the history, because I'm not going to know what the vaccine ingredients are, so I just mostly just stay with the history of what actually happened around 1990. And what happened, coincidentally, was that there was a massive change in the pediatric schedule of vaccinations, in potency and number and coverage rates. And people should always remember about the coverage rates, because parents were slow to vaccinate their kids until they were ready for school. So there was a big delay as well, until the kids were 4 or 5 years old. That changed in the late 80s through the early 90s. There's so much more history to this. Do you want me to tell you some more story on that?
Yeah, tell us about the vaccine court and President Reagan.
Okay. Well,
I don't think people know about that.
They don't know that? I just told this part of the story. I mean, it's an American story, but it impacts other countries, because we followed what the Americans did. The World Health Organization sort of, you know, they work together and to keep consistency and so on. And it's a, you know, within the Western countries in particular at that time, we all just followed what the Americans were doing. And what happened is, and it's a little bit of a long story, but in the 70s when we had the pandemic that never arrived, and there were a lot of people that were injected with a hastily created flu vaccine, there were a lot of injuries. And Guillain-Barré syndrome was, and other neurological issues came into the forefront at that time, and people were starting to sue vaccine makers for having done this. And so it became, the environment for vaccine makers became so litigious that they were leaving the market for vaccines. They just couldn't stay in it. It was just too expensive for them, and their insurance rates were huge and so on and so forth. So the American government, recognizing this, stepped in, because they were seeing, oh my gosh, we're not going to have a supply of the vaccines we need when we want them, so we've got to protect the vaccine makers. So they, in the Reagan era, they passed legislation. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was an outcome of an act that was passed in 1986, I think it was. And this, in effect, barred parents, anybody who believed they suffered a vaccine injury, from directly suing a manufacturer. They had to go through the government, prove to the government first, and even then they could settle and just pay out money to that potentially injured person without impacting the vaccine makers at all at that time.
Right.
So what happened instantly, with the market then being relieved, or the makers being relieved of any liability, there was suddenly, they all came into the market, and there was heated competition for new vaccines that the government, the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, came out with a diseases of priority list. And one at the top was the hemophilia influenza B, was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
They were already making that when they came out with that diseases of priority list. And so this sort of, all the vaccine makers in Canada too, they all jumped in with products for this Hib B vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, they began to introduce it to kids, and coverage rates increased, and they through the early 90s, they started to roll them together. There were combination vaccines before that, but they were rolling then the Hib B in with the DPT, and then the IPV, the polio. So you've got five vaccines ultimately by about 1994 in a single needle.
Wow.
So you've got increased numbers of diseases that they were starting to address as time went on as well. They were in combination shots, very potent, and coverage rates started to soar, and they threw money at campaigns to get kids right out of the womb. We're starting to do that here in Canada with the hepatitis, but in the U.S., you get your K1, you get your for the blood clotting, you get your hepatitis, then at 2 months you get your DPT, IPV plus Hib, either as a pentavalent product, and it's just sort of moved forward from there. Now by the mid 90s. Late 90s, they were up to 95% coverage rates of kids who were 2 months of age. So that coincidental with the history of what happened in the sudden rise of severe allergy in children, you put the two of those things together with the history of even just those words, anaphylaxis and allergy, and you've got a really interesting picture.
Right.
And people will, they'll point to me and they'll say, well, you're not a doctor. No. And I'm glad I'm not, because if I were, I wouldn't be able to say this. So I'm a mom who had a kid who, by the age of one, was severely allergic to peanuts, nuts. We had an issue with dairy. There were other foods involved, environmental reactions, eczema, asthma. And I want to know why. I wanted to know why. And so, as I say, finally, when he got to an age where he was taking care of himself and my anxiety perhaps was a little bit less, we'd managed to deal with a number of the allergies through other means, through nutrition, through supplements, through the energy work that has been so, so interesting and helpful, that he's a lot better than he was. We are still working on the peanut, though. It's still there. The number has dropped, his IgE level, and we were talking about this earlier, that, and I don't know if he'd appreciate me talking about him, because he's 18 now.
If he would, yeah.
If he would. But so many of those atopic issues, we've managed to recover from them. He's still, as they say, we're still struggling with the peanut, but we still go for our RAST IgE test. I kind of do the same one every time to keep it consistent. And his number has dropped over the last few years. It's still in the danger zone, still moving forward and still learning as we move forward.
And that's with your the new body talk practitioner training that you have. Is that energy work that you're talking about? Or
we're into a different kind of a different thing. But like any mom, you want your child to get better now. And we were talking about this earlier. You almost become a little bit manic in your desire to help your child get better. I've learned some really interesting lessons in the field of energy medicine. And I came to this many years ago, as I was saying, when he was about seven or so, where we had, I'm not going to, we were introduced to a protocol that accessed the energy of the body through meridians, and you're probably familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that it helped. When we started, of course, his level was off the charts. It was level 6. They stopped counting. You're so sensitive. But when we went through this protocol with another practitioner that long ago, and we went back for our blood test, his level had dropped from a 6 to a 4. And so
wow.
I thought, my God, there's something to this. I don't understand what this is, but I'm going to do some more research, and I'm going to find out, well, what is this and what is the potential here? And the potential for some people is that through energy protocols, and there are many of them out there, that for some people, they can, through the blood tests and their IgE would be undetectable. I don't say the allergy is gone, but you go for the blood test and you find that they can no longer detect IgE to a specific food. I've seen that, mm-hmm. but it works beautifully for some people and partially for others, and then not at all for some other people. And the reasons for that, sometimes I understand them and sometimes I don't. But I still felt that there is potential there. So I learned something in 2007 called BIE, bioenergetic intolerance elimination. And I think they're sort of, I left them, I lost my faith in the organization, but not in energy, of course. And mm-hmm. so I left them and I moved over to more energy work in Body Talk. And Body Talk is relatively new. It was developed by an Australian chiropractor who was unable to get better from a disease that he had. He got to a certain level, but he couldn't get beyond it. And it is an energy-based, consciousness-based. It's a little bit complicated. To do it is very simple, but to kind of understand how the mind and the body work together to either create imbalance and illness or to recover from it can be very complicated and surprising. For instance, a person who might have an allergy could have stored emotion that they experienced during an event when they were very small, and they would never remember that maybe, but the body would. And so
right.
that's just as an example. If you tap into and you get the body to resolve and recover from this stored emotion, there is a possibility then for you to begin to heal.
Mm-hmm.
So the Body Talk allows me to help people do that, to help identify and resolve mind-body issues. And I've used it for allergy, and it's worked beautifully for some people again. But
right,
it's a bit of a struggle for other people. You just keep persisting with it, and I guess that's what I've done. I've just persisted in these areas to find things that work.
Everybody's just a little bit different, so that's why it's not 100% guarantee that anything.
Yeah, that's works. Right. And everybody's different, and absolutely, of course, the nutrition and the supplements and cleanses, and just keeping as strong as you can and understanding where your weaknesses are is really important. I wanted to point to that allergy relief book. It's a skinny mm-hmm. little book, and I self-published this because I just wanted to get it out there. It's something that I've used that is so simple. It costs nothing. This protocol costs nothing. You can do it yourself, but I recommend it for minor allergy symptoms to give it a whirl. And basically, you're tapping on acupressure points connected to meridians in the body, which are the invisible pathways of energy, and
mm-hmm.
you're tapping. And it's right there in the book. You start, one of the points is at the eye, and then at the nostrils and the chest and the ribs. There are points on the feet, on the legs, and the finger. And you just tap on these. I started using it on myself when I had a mosquito bite, which is a histamine reaction. And I remember when I first, just like a eureka moment kind of thing, I knew about these points, but I hadn't tapped on them. I'd always used kind of a device in this other protocol that I'd used to access those points. But just by tapping on these points, you can release the energy,
mm-hmm.
and the body will stand down. That the mosquito bite that I had, as I was doing the tapping, it stopped itching, and it calmed down. Within an hour, there's nothing to be seen. So it is so simple, and I just put it out there for people to learn how to do this as a tool. I don't mean it to replace anything. I just mean it as something that's an additional tool that you can use that is so easy, and all you need is your finger to do the tapping.
Is that the same as the emotional freedom technique or EFT?
It's along the same lines. They're different points, and there's a man, a doctor, a chiropractor online, and his name is Jim Scott. And if you were to Google him, Jim Scott, chiropractor, tapping points, allergies, something of that nature, you'd come up with his free PDF that's there as well, where he has, he calls it a cure. I stay away from, I don't call anything a cure. I think you recover from things, but He calls
right.
it a cure. But he will have similar points on this PDF where you can learn about it there, too. So all of this has been around for a long time. It's nothing that I've invented. I learned about it through the energy work. I learned about it from Jim Scott. There are other people out there. There's a couple of German doctors that began using technology. They've got a book called The Biophysical Therapy of Allergies. And there are devices out there, if anybody was interested in that, like the Bicom that Dr. Kropp, for instance, here in Canada, I don't know who would use it in the U.S., but if you were to Google Bicom, you would find someone who used it in the U.S. for allergies. And they access some of the same points. So, again, this is within, you know, nothing I created. It's in traditional Chinese medicine. The tapping's in Ayurveda as well.
Right.
It's in Eastern practices. The tapping on the body has just been around for a long time.
Right.
Although
we're just now discovering these things, we're like, what?
Well, I think we've gotten away from, or moved away from this type of knowledge, or it's been discouraged because it looks crazy, or it's from another place in the world, or, you know, that's if it works, it works. And if you're open to it, you know, I say give it a try, absolutely. We need all the help we can get as allergy parents. So there you are.
Yeah, there we are.
There you are.
Well, here we are. So just circling back, because I think a lot of people may not still be clear enough on why there is a peanut allergy epidemic. I know you laid out some of the clues. Are there any other clues that we left out, say like aluminum as an adjuvant or those kinds of things?
I think the kids, at the bottom line, boiling it down, I think the kids are overwhelmed. And we have overwhelmed them. This is something that we have created as a society. This didn't come out of the blue. It's not something that's descended upon us like, you know, like some type of metaphoric monster that's come. We have created this through our own levels of our own lifestyle and the toxicities that we've created within our own environment. And some of those toxicities come from the vaccinations, the antibiotics, pharmaceuticals. But I always point to Margie Proffitt, who wrote this amazing essay in 1991, and it was called The Function of Allergy. And it was a bit startling to me when I first ran across it. Allergy has a function. This horrible thing actually has a purpose. It's not a disease. It's not a dysfunction. You mean that it's there for a reason? And she defines allergy as an evolved defense against acute toxicity. Oh, okay. So where are we experiencing the toxicity? And it's acute because it's gotten into the body and the body's responded with this defense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a horrible defense. You know, why can't it be, you know, something else? And why do we have to have the itching and the vomiting and the diarrhea and the drop in blood pressure and all this? And she suggests in this essay that it is to expel the toxin. This response, these symptoms that we have, are intended to eject this perceived toxin as fast as possible from the body, and it's perceived to be so threatening because it's gotten into the bloodstream.
Okay.
And the body has just made this decision under situations that were so extreme and so threatening, whether that is related to the mind or you've experienced a sudden toxic exposure. The body is just thrown into this defense suddenly, and so that when you're exposed to it next time, the body will say, oh, my God, all red alert, and so you will start vomiting. Everybody's just a little bit different, but the itching designed to release it from the skin, the coughing to try and get it out, the drop in blood pressure to prevent this perceived toxin from circulating to your vital organs. So this is what she says in her essay, that the body will, in anaphylaxis, will risk death in order to prevent certain death. It's an evolved response, and it was so infrequently provoked before the 20th century, but so massively provoked in recent years because we have done it. We have provoked this ourselves. We have thrown the kids into a situation of acute toxicity. And again, I go back and I point to that moment around 1990 where something suddenly changed to create this in so many kids, hundreds of thousands, and now, you know, how many in other countries as well now. So in those other countries, again, wherever you see peanut allergy pop up, and did I mention Tasmania a little bit earlier, where it first emerged in ACT, the capital territory of Australia, but not in Tasmania. Well, after 2001, it popped up in Tasmania. Well, there's another piece of the mystery. Oh, my gosh, what's happening there? Well, they didn't have the coverage rates. They had the same vaccines, but they had extremely low coverage rates. As soon as they brought up the coverage rates, oh, my gosh, all of a sudden we've got severe peanut allergy there. Okay, it pops up in Singapore. Okay, around after 2001, parents, although it's not mandatory to use the Hib B vaccine, they found it convenient to use the 5-in-1. Suddenly you've got, and the 5-in-1 I described as those five vaccines in a single needle, suddenly you've got peanut allergy there. In my book, I predicted that it would emerge in India next, where they were thinking about using the Hib B in the 5-in-1. It wasn't feasible at the time, but then they started to use it. Oh my gosh, suddenly now we have peanut allergy in India. So wherever you have these levels of acute toxicity happening, provoked, and I'm going to say in large measure as a result of the use of severe, highly potent vaccines that, as you're saying, also can include aluminum, toxoids designed to provoke an immune response. That's what they're there for. But people don't realize that while you're trying to get the good thing from it, where you're getting the increase in antibodies to the pathogen, the bad viruses or the bacteria that you're vaccinating for, at the same time, you also get the natural response of the IgE. It goes sky high when you use the tetanus toxoid in the conjugate for the Hib B. Mm-hmm. So you get both of these things at the same time. You don't get one or the other. You get them both at the same time. And the hope is that the body just calms down after a while and the IgE disappears because it's got like a half-life of, I don't know, it lasts a couple of days in the body and the body just keeps producing it. If the body stands down, then it will stop producing it. So it is just such a compelling story here that I've been telling for the last number of years. And it, from my perspective, there just didn't seem to be any question that this has provoked in hundreds of thousands and millions of kids these severe allergies.
Right.
Our medical establishment will say, no, we cannot. We know that it creates allergies. They know that the vaccines create allergies and can create severe allergy. But they don't want to talk about it because they don't want to stop vaccinating, because then they are fearful that they'll see an emergence of these diseases. And that's a possibility.
Did you watch the congressional hearings back in, I think it was November of last year, when they had the head of the NIH or the CDC, or I think it was the CDC, and they kept asking her, like, were there any safety studies that were conducted on vaccines?
Yeah.
And she hemmed and she hawed and she hemmed and she hawed, but the answer is no, there have been none.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're doing is you're vaccinating these kids before their immune systems are mature, and like you pointed out in your book, I think you said before 1986 or before 1990, there were seven vaccines that were given to children, and over a spaced out course of time, and the kids are older at that point anyway, and then all of a sudden you have this dramatic increase, like the, you know, large number of vaccines per needle, and they're, you know, from birth on. And so that's when you're seeing the inflection point, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just, you know, history has, you can't change what has happened. That's what happened. And people keep saying, well, it's such a mystery. I think we've solved the mystery. I don't think, there are so many people, though, that are afraid to talk about this. And, of course, I understand why.
Right.
That they don't want to be ostracized or shunned or frozen out of any organization or any group. You know, when I say it out loud, I I've had some of that. Most of the time, though, I kind of get quiet. People are quiet. Some just come out and they just agree and they say, oh my God, you know, that just makes complete sense to me. But to get the story out there, I mean, do you know how big these pharmaceutical corporations are? I'm very small. You know, mm-hmm. I'm one voice here that's telling a story. The entire autism community seems to be telling the same story.
They do.
But, you know, until you have, I guess, people are incredulous, until you have a doctor saying it, or until you have an organization mm-hmm. in authority saying that this is the problem, you know, people are going to remain incredulous and quiet, I suppose, and wondering and worried. I understand, though, that some people are delaying shots. They're spacing them out. They're making their own choices about this where they can.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm completely in favor of informed consent. Get all the information you can get, make your own decision, because at the end of the day, you live with the outcome of what decisions you've made
right.
and the actions you've taken. But as long as you're fully informed of the whole story, I think that's my biggest concern, is that the information is not getting out there to people, the full story.
Yeah, I mean, we put our full faith and trust in our doctors and our medical system to think that, you know, here, you know, you have my health, you take care of it, you've designed these things for my best health, and it turns out that that's not the case. And it really does take a whole lot of effort and energy in convincing. It's not something that people can just usually do overnight to convince themselves that, you know,
I think we've
the government
been,
doesn't...
We've been asleep.
We've
been asleep for a very long time, and I certainly was when I took my child in for the shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I did what my mother did. I didn't question. I just went along with everything, and it's a very comfortable life we live here, and you put your faith in the doctor and your trust in the doctor because that's what you always do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't start to question until something goes wrong.
Right.
And then you start asking questions, you start asking hard questions, and you realize that you've been living in a bubble, a very comfortable
right.
bubble, and that when you ask questions, and if they're too hard, they'll look at you sideways, and they'll say, as one doctor did to me when I started asking questions, he said to me, are you, you know, my child who was two or three at that point, he said, are you going to be giving your child peanut butter? Pardon me? What are you hearing when I say I'm concerned about these? What are you hearing me say? He was in a completely different mind space, and looking at me like I was probably an hysterical mother.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And I didn't know what I'm talking about, and I'm not a doctor, and yada yada, the whole story. And I shut up from then on. I just shut right up, and I didn't talk to doctors anymore about this, because I looked on his wall, I looked around me, and I thought, this man has the entire weight of the government, the medical establishment, and he has the power to take my child away from me, was my thought. And that was it for me. And maybe that's why I didn't write the book until my son was a lot older, because
exactly.
I was made to be afraid, and I was afraid.
It has happened before, where, you know, parents have had their children taken away from them after doing what they think is the right thing and against their doctor has said.
There was a story of the child with PANDAS, and she was on a very specific diet and was doing well, and they saw that she was giving the government, I guess, saw that they were giving the child supplements and changes and so on, and they didn't approve of that, and they did. They took the child away. Anyway, one needs to be a little bit cautious. I'm less cautious now that my kids are older.
Yeah. You can afford to be.
I can afford to be, you know. They come knocking on my door, they'll only get me. So
Right.
And that's perfectly fine, and I'm not willing to be quiet at all.
Well, there's the Facebook group, and they've also got a great website too, the Thinking Moms Revolution, for people who haven't heard of them. And they're mostly autism moms that swear up and down that their kids have regressed into autism, usually after the 18-month checkup in which the MMR is given. And, you know, we've heard all these stories about how it's not true. And but, you know, I think if people really did their research and really dug and found out the truth, that they could, you know, like you did and like I did, convince ourselves that the whole story is not being told and that we're, you know, a large part of it is being kept hidden from us. So you really need to learn how to think for yourself, and that's what they do there. It's a great resource for people to check out.
Yeah, it is. One of my concerns moving forward is to try and build a bridge between the strictly food allergy parents and community and the autism community. Mm-hmm. And you might have seen I published an article in Autism File magazine. Autism File magazine, and it's titled "The Autism and Allergy Overlap," to point out those areas where the communities do share a lot in common, including, you know, the fact of the sudden and simultaneous emergence of the two epidemics at the same time. You know, suddenly it seemed over the last 20 years, we're back to that refrain, we didn't have this when I was young. No, we didn't. It's just we've had this incredible, terrible explosion in illness and degenerative chronic illnesses and autism and allergies in children in particular, of course. And that both epidemics have worsened, they've deepened the relationships of food triggers and avoidance in both communities, and the gender split, where you have in the autism, you have kids on the spectrum, boys in particular, 4 to 1, 4 boys to every 1 girl, and in peanut allergy, it's 2 boys for every girl with peanut allergy. So, and the GI tract being a huge issue in both, and even now when we were talking about the hygiene hypothesis, it is now being brought in as an explanation, one of the explanations for causes of autism. And in it again, they're not coming out and talking about vaccinations, but it's there on the table.
Yeah, the New York Times ran that article a few months ago. At least they're sort of bringing that piece of it to the public's perception, which is good. I mean, at least it gets the public thinking more of it's not just something, it can't be just genetic, although that's all the research that's being done these days, because that's what's being funded, to look for a genetic answer for these kinds of things, even though, you know, the rate of autism has skyrocketed.
Right.
It's now 1 in 88, and ADHD and asthma as well. They call them the 4A disorders. Everything, it seemed to be this huge inflection point starting at 1990.
Yeah, we've done this to ourselves, unfortunately. But now I think that we're waking up. Parents are waking up. They're more cautious. They're thinking. They're asking more questions. You know, there's terrific hope for the future. I don't know what's going to be the tipping point here.
Our film.
What's that? Sorry?
Our film. The
Our
film. We're going to be the tipping point.
Go for
it. You got to help us get a maid.
Well, that's right. You can't stop. You've got to just keep moving forward on all fronts, on recovering the kids, on stopping them from being thrown into the river in the first place, upstream, as well as catching them downstream. It's huge, and the political will is not quite there, however, to shift. And, you know, in Canada in particular, the discussion is not going, it's not moving. It's there is no discussion. That's why I looked to the Americans to keep stirring things up and to keep talking about it. And I'll be going to Autism One. Yeah, Autism One.
Yeah, I saw that. You just
huge.
Registered.
Yeah, I saw Robert Kennedy Jr. will be attending as the keynote speaker, and he has a child, I understand, with peanut allergy as well, and asthma. So I'm keen to hear what else he has to say
And it's nice to see these bridges, like you said, being built from, say, like the autism community. And for people that don't really know about the autism community, they've been involved in biomedical recovery of kids, and that's what we at Epidemic Answers talk about mostly. But it seems like they sort of keep the information to themselves, and it doesn't really get out there to the community at large with other people, like you say, with allergies and asthma and ADHD. But it pertains to everybody, which is what we at Epidemic Answers say.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know how many children on the spectrum also have life-threatening food allergies. Some parents with kids on the spectrum, they, you know, when I first started to talk about this with them, said, "Oh, we don't have allergies. We don't, you know, we don't have that problem." Well, they avoid foods that are triggers for other symptoms that make other symptoms worse. So how are we defining allergy here? You know, as the classic with the hives and the wheezing and the vomiting and so on.
IgE versus the IgG.
You get different types of allergy, and it manifests in different ways in people as well. It's a whole discussion that should be happening between the two communities, but you know, the allergy community might be wondering, well, we don't have autism here. We've just got allergies. Well, a lot of parents sort of dismiss some of the other symptoms that, for me, echo what I see in the autism community, like what we call the ADHD or the sensory issues or rage or, you know, motor skill issues that I see in a lot of the kids that have allergies. So to kind of bridge those gaps and kind of say, we're in the same boat here. We've had the same causes, but as I was saying in the article, it's like one overwhelmed child turned left while the other one turned right, that we're in this together. You know, not shouldn't be pushing one away and denying certain things, and, you know, how many kids are on medications that are also have allergies, so.
Right.
Anyway, it's quite the story.
It's a big task.
It is. We've got a lot of work to do.
Okay. Well, with that, we've got a question that came in. For anybody that has a question, go ahead and hit *2 to raise your hand if you want to ask by phone. I've got one that came in from Michelle in New Canaan. And she says, in particular, why peanut? Why is that the chosen food for high anaphylaxis? Is it the molecular structure? I'm told it may be the mold on peanuts. Why are some kids allergic to dairy and others to nuts? My brother was given a ton of vaccines before the Gulf War and developed a severe walnut allergy. Why walnut for him? Thanks. Thoughts?
Wow. That's a good
question. That's a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, why one food for this person and another food for the other person. I'm going to say that when one has an injection of something toxic or has a toxic exposure, or even in my experience, a severely upsetting event, let's say, has something that shocks their system, that the gut, which is almost like they call it your second brain, your enteric immune system, that it will respond defensively, and it will prime itself for defense. And one of these defenses is allergy, and inflammation will occur, and you'll have antibodies being produced in order to protect you. And my thought is on this, that at that moment when you're experiencing whatever the toxicity is, whatever is present, whatever is in the gut just before, during, or even after, that the body will, in its infinite wisdom, will make a decision that this is a threat, and it will do so to protect you. When we look at the top eight, I think something that they might have in common is that they require a lot of digestion. In nuts in particular, they're designed to defy digestion and to just, you know that when animals eat them, just to sort of poop them on the ground, and then you've got fertilizer and you've got plants. They're seeds, and they're protected that way, and they are hard to digest, and I think they hang around, and that's one of the reasons that the body might respond that way. It could also be that there is another level of toxicity involved, because it's not linear. Of course, it never is. That you've got that mold on the peanut as well. But you know, if we look at mold as an issue, if we're just going to look at peanut, well, we didn't have peanut anaphylaxis, raging peanut anaphylaxis, before around 1990, before the early 90s. It existed, mm-hmm. and it was climbing slowly, very slowly. But then you had this explosion. So what I'm saying is that there's a pairing of what happens to be there at the time you have this toxic exposure.
Mm-hmm.
That might explain why it's this for this person and not that person. And you've got, of course, the individual variables. But, you know, certainly for us, you know, I was a happy peanut butter eater. Always had been.
Right.
So I didn't see any reason to change or, you know. So anyway, right. That's one explanation. Yeah.
Okay. And then we have another question from Sarah. She says, what role does the speaker, you, think that GMOs or genetically modified organisms, which were also introduced in the mid-1990s, has in peanut allergy? My understanding was that immune system started reacting to GMO soy, which is also a legume, leading to reactions to peanuts. Really enjoying this excellent talk. Thank you.
That's great. Soy, peanut, legumes, oil, seeds, they all, of course, share similar proteins that one can develop a sensitivity to peanut, nut, because they're so similar, the body just makes a decision. But as far as the GMO goes, I think it's a really bad idea. They didn't change the peanut, for example. They did change the soy. I guess you're saying mm-hmm. in the mid 90s they changed the soy to GMO.
Yeah.
I don't know. I focused on the history first and the explosion of what happened and when it happened. I don't know that it certainly confused things. People mm-hmm. don't know what they're eating anymore. We don't know how we're digesting it, how we're reacting to it. What was the study on was affecting the livers of rats, and it was doing terrible things in some of the studies.
Oh, the French study about GMOs, GMO corn, I think it was.
Oh,
yeah,
with corn.
Nasty little
corn.
Cancers that they would develop like after 12 weeks or something of eating it. It's
yeah.
gross.
It is. It's just what we've done to our food chain is really,
yeah.
it's frightening, and we're not in control anymore of those things. So we just kind of retreat maybe to our own farm somewhere in a distant mountain, and I don't know. But I don't have a clear answer to that about the relationship of the GMO soy and the peanut. Again, I just focused on that moment when things suddenly changed
mm-hmm.
and that it's persisted. It might play a role because it's certainly in almost every processed food that you buy these days.
Right.
Yeah.
I know that Jeffrey Smith over at the Institute for Responsible Technology, which is one of the leading organizations out there campaigning against GMOs and saying what the health dangers are, they'll make the case of how allergies and asthma and autism have risen at the same time, you know, that genetically modified foods have been introduced into the food supply. And the corn is actually probably the worst, which is really scary because it has the BT toxin in it, which is a
yeah.
pesticide
yeah.
that's designed to explode the guts of the pest or the bug that's eating the corn. And
yeah.
so you're eating the corn, that same corn, and it's doing the same thing to your guts too. And so
yeah.
you know, causing those perforations in your gut and the whole leaky gut, you know, that could certainly set off a whole immune system reaction too.
Yeah, well, I go back to that definition by Margie Proffitt of allergy being an evolved defense against acute toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
So we've allowed this the overwhelming conditions to develop, you know, where, you know, if you have a really, really bad day and you're really upset about something, then suddenly you've got an allergy. Well, that's on top of everything else that you've been ingesting and storing in the body and unable to successfully detox because you're constantly assaulted by things in the water, things in the food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it is a whole picture. But I can't get away from the history of that moment when suddenly something changed, again, just for kids. We have
right.
allergies increasing in adults, too. But, you know, on an individual level, it hasn't increased dramatically like it has for kids. There were some of the numbers that I had there where it sort of stayed steady for adults at about 0.5% of adults with life-threatening food allergy. But now that our kids, the first wave, like mine, have reached maturity and there's no, you know, going on to 19 and 20, he will be entering the adult statistics. So then you'll be seeing the adult number go up.
Right, right.
So there's a little bit of a shift there that might seem a little confusing, but anyway, good question.
There's a whole lot of information muddling everything up. It's hard to like pick it apart. But
yeah.
what you talked about, like with the stressful day, and you know that goes back to the mind body connection that you were talking about before with the whole body talk thing, and how that stress response can really exacerbate things.
And yeah, I've had clients actually who suddenly develop anaphylaxis to various foods, and they come in and they're confused about why I haven't had any problem ever, and suddenly I have this. Did something happen recently in your life? And you know, yes, there was a breakup, there was a divorce, there was a you know something tragic that happened. So, not ever to dismiss the even the nonverbal reactions. I mean, when you have your child, and if you have these toxic exposures, you know, doctors used to think babies didn't have any feelings. I just, it's insane. They will react, and their body will remember everything that's happened, and they will store it, and they will remember it. So never to dismiss memories, thoughts, feelings as playing a role in allergy for sure.
It's all
in
connected.
Any,
in any disease or in any
anything.
Disorder.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we have a question from Mindy and Rye. She says, most of the studies done to date with allergies have been epidemiological. I have long thought that more focused studies need to be done that take into account genetic factors. Most older generations have allergy affinity, and their offspring may therefore be more susceptible to severe allergies. Would you agree? Have you thought of other studies can be developed that would get more to the root of the problem?
Oh, so suggesting that if mom has a hidden allergy or something of that nature, that could
like,
be passed on, something like that. I have wondered about that, you know, for instance, I get the question often, you know, why did this child develop peanut allergy, and even in the same family, the other child didn't? And they might have had the same shots, for example, as well. Well, they would have, I'm going to suggest, some difficulty in detoxifying and managing the exposures that they're having and what they're consuming and how they are detoxifying the pathways in the liver, for example, and the role of, well, what did mom experience? That's quite right. Did mom pass on a level of candida?
Right.
We've got mercury fillings. We've got other issues that have been coming to light that problematic that you might have passed on. And that just sort of adds to the picture of toxicity that, okay, this child, okay, mom had the mercury fillings and she had candida and the child was born with it. You didn't know that. Then you add another level of toxicity and it shouldn't be a surprise that you end up with a problem. So
doctors just don't know that yet.
They don't. So
I know my pediatricians didn't. But they're like, you don't live in a toxic waste dump. I'm like, you haven't seen my heavy metal test results yet. Where are my kids? Have you?
So that's right. You don't know. You know, maybe you've had an exposure and you're not even aware of it, and you pass that on to the child. Well, you know, the world has changed so much. I don't know if we're going to get big studies on this because it takes so much money and the will of the medical establishment to do these things. But I think at the individual level, to introduce some types of screenings, instead of just saying, okay, well, does your baby have a cold today? And that kind of being the end of the questionnaire, perhaps to do some deeper, more rigorous screening before one goes ahead with other types of procedures like vaccination. You know, to do
right, or if a mom was administered antibiotics during delivery, labor and delivery, I mean, that's going to set her child up immediately for a compromised immune system. And that's what we at Epidemic Answer say is that, you know, never ever compromise, I mean, never vaccinate anybody that's got a compromised immune system, because it's just setting
you. Well, how are you going to know? It's like the doctor when I went back after my son had a severely adverse reaction to the vaccine, and he's sitting in his little bucket chair, and I'm telling him this story of what happened, and it was so frightening and horrible, and he just screamed for hours, and he says, it looks fine now. He looks fine now. And I go, yeah, but there's something else going on here that we can't see. And I think that's part of the problem. And I think for parents to be aware and proactive in looking at these potentials, doing a little blood test maybe, doing a urine analysis. I don't know, you know, admittedly, again, not being a doctor, but mm-hmm. but to look at the you know, what are the factors here that are, what are the risk factors here? What should we be looking at? When it comes to vaccination or delaying or any of that kind of thing, but we'll never get to that point because it's not cost effective. So the parent has to take on that responsibility, herself or himself. That's why it's one shot fits all, one size fits all, and it's mass because it's cost effective.
Right.
And they work the numbers. And if you're one of the unlucky ones, to develop anaphylaxis or any other kind of issue, again, then you are on your own. You do your research. You have informed consent. You make the decision. You move forward, and you live with what happens one way or the other. You know, if you believe that you have to have a vaccine to prevent you from getting measles, which mm-hmm. everybody kind of used to get in the old days, but now we're made afraid of it, you make your decision based on that. But even the doctors are saying, well, gosh, well, now we need these pathogens. They believe that we've messed up the balance in our immune systems because we're not exposed to enough of these things. We've
right.
suppressed them.
Right.
So, you know, even they're starting to talk along these lines now.
Yeah,
they're still not willing to say. Yeah. Sorry?
Yeah. Go ahead.
They're still not willing to say, okay, maybe you should delay this. Some doctors are.
Yeah.
I haven't met any of them yet, but I hear that they're out there.
Yeah, there's some in New York that'll do that.
Are there some in New York?
Oh, Dr. Pilecki, I believe.
Yeah, you're right.
There's William Sears, who has a book about it. And then the frustrating thing for the parents, I mean, going back to the vaccine court, is that I believe I'm not a lawyer, but those records are sealed and they cannot be used as evidence for any other trial. So it's
a
standalone case, and the information and the results are not really released. You don't really know what happened.
Yeah.
You don't know what evidence was brought, so that evidence cannot be used for any other trial, I think. I'm not quite sure, but that's my understanding of it. And so it makes it hard to prove. You can't just build your case building on other people's cases. You have to, like, go in, you know, have all that money for your legal defense team,
go up against
the U.S. government and try to prove it. And it's kind of hard to do.
We don't even have that here in Canada. There's never been a successful suit brought, period. We don't have that kind of compensation program, there's such flaws everywhere you turn, but if a vaccine maker and even the government will know that within their analysis of outcomes from vaccination, they know there's going to be a certain number of injuries. I mean, vaccination is an unavoidably risky event, and the courts agree with that. And if it is unavoidably risky and there is going to be damage and it's going to be so many numbers of people and they know what they are, shouldn't there be, if we're going to, and this is a whole other big discussion on philosophy here in terms of, you know, should we be, you know, if we're going to talk about this idea of a herd immunity, which is needs its own analysis, you know, there should be compensation for people who have, if they're injured, that they should be recognized as such, and they should be compensated because it's like almost like going to war, that you'll be compensated for having sacrificed yourself for the good of the whole. That doesn't exist here. It just gets swept under the rug. I got a stack of reports, adverse events from Health Canada. We've had deaths, of course, And it's right there. You don't get the names and some of the details, of course, but you see that, okay, to that vaccine in that period of time, we had this many deaths and we had this many types of reactions and so on. And you know that it happens, but nothing
right.
is ever done about it, that whatever costs there were to that vaccine, to that product, that the pharmaceutical company will never have to pay it, that the people
right.
who have been exposed to it will have to absorb every bit of that for the rest of their lives. And that's wrong. They know this happens. Everybody knows it happens. But nobody wants to talk about it.
Right.
So that's
right.
just another layer on top of everything else. But how bad is the damage? We'll never know because they're not connecting the two publicly. They're not going to do those big
mm-hmm.
studies.
And they're not allowed to say anything about it once it gets settled. It gets sealed.
Yeah.
We've got about 10 minutes left, and Michelle has another question. She says, wasn't there a case with Harold Buttram where he proved that a baby had an anaphylaxis because peanut was in the vaccine? Is neomycin made with peanut oil? I tried to access the court case but couldn't get it. Have you heard of this?
Well, I was contacted by Harold Buttram, was that a couple of years ago when he does court cases. He defends parents who've been accused of or gives evidence for parents who've been accused of shaken baby syndrome, where
mm-hmm.
the vaccine actually, for people who don't know, can cause such severe damage that it looks like the child has been beaten. Just awful.
No.
I just can't even fathom it. I mean, I've heard about it and so on and done research online, but he got in touch with me about this, the research I'd done on the peanut, refined peanut oil being used in Adjuvant 65, for example, which was a product Merck came out with in the early 60s, and it was used in experimentally in flu vaccines, and it was licensed in the UK, but it was never licensed in the US. But it, you know, anyway, there, it was used as a shining example of an adjuvant that did not use a mineral oil, that used a vegetable oil, and so there were less damages, fewer injuries. Anyway, so that this was seen to be in our vaccines, Dr. Buttram used as an example of, we don't really know, do we, what's in our vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't using it sort of to prove that we had peanut oil in the vaccines. It was shown to be, okay, this is a big question mark here. We don't know, do we? That was sort of the defense. We don't know what we're consuming. We're not allowed to know when we ask. We can't get the information that we want. It's protected in a couple of ways. One is by corporate law, where they don't have to share ingredients at all if
mm-hmm.
it's patented, and so on. And by peanut oil, refined peanut oil, being generally recognized as safe. That's that GRAS status that they have.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be declared because it's not toxic. So, you know, he was just, that was that rationale there. It wasn't that it was actually in the vaccine. It's that it could be, and we
right,
don't really
right.
know. So.
Yeah, and I've heard or read that a lot of times things are done during processing, and there may be some sort of residual ingredient that's left over that's below the threshold that needs to be there so that they can actually leave
yeah.
it out from the list of ingredients. So
yeah.
things like Thimerosal, we think we're getting Thimerosal-free shots, and we may not be, because there may be that residual amount that's still in there. It's just sort of like trans fats on the label. If it says 0 grams of trans fats, not necessarily 0 grams of trans
yeah.
fat. It could just be below that 0.5 grams that, you know, it's the cutoff point. And so
that's right. And I was even wondering about the GMO peanut that they came out with, because it's not allergy-free. Nobody's going to touch it who has an allergy to peanut, but the level of protein had been reduced to such a point that it then passed a different standard and could retain its GRAS status because it had a lower level of protein, you know, in the refining process. Anyway, so there you go again.
There we go.
There you go again. But it's interesting. I was a book I was reading recently in which they mentioned Karski versus Nike in a lawsuit where don't know if you heard about it, an American consumer advocate where he took Nike to court for lying in the press. And this is a whole other story, but corporations are considered to be people. They mm-hmm. they are personhood, and they have, in the U.S., the rights of individuals. And in the lawsuit, which finally fell apart, it went to the Supreme Court, they just wouldn't even hear it because the corporation was given the right of free speech and the right
yep.
to lie. So at the end of the day, a corporation doesn't ever have to tell the truth to the public. That's what the Supreme Court seemed to be ratifying in that instance.
Yeah.
So
that's for your next book.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's a really good point. I think people just don't understand that.
It is these organizations, these corporations are so huge and they have so much money. And another little bit in the most recently, I'm not good on American politics, okay, but apparently in this book, Obama had to go to the corporations and the medical establishment before he could start passing his health legislation, because apparently they had done that to Hillary Clinton, where they sort of skewered her in the media. And so he had a meeting with them, and he said, "Now, I'd like to do this, this, and this, and I'd like your support. And in exchange, I'm going to give you a whole lot of customers."
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting situation that that's part of our little story too, isn't it? The things that go on behind the scenes politically, and we have no say. They make the decisions for us, and then
right.
we're really not given the full story.
Yeah.
So information.
You got to do your
power. Yeah.
Which is why we're getting out there. We're saying this kind of stuff. So check
yeah.
us out. We're on epidemicanswers.org and mariarickerthong.org, and then also .com, mariarickerthong.com, and then at heatherfraser.org. And I highly recommend your book. I think it's a great book and well worth a read for people who want to know the history and what's going on with this. So thank you. I really appreciate it. I think we've had some great discussion and great questions today.
Yeah, that was really great. I appreciate it. And we'll do more of the same. We'll just keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
Great.
Take
Bye.
Care. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
The